My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pyle and Frank Muir challenge Anscott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
We go straight into the first round, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, what's the dictionary meaning of these words? Beginning with Dennis Norden. Dennis, a blatherskite, or, if you prefer it, a blatherskate.
It's a distinction without a difference. It's Scottish. I can hear a voice saying, "Hold your blather, Dr. Cameron." It means sort of rabbiting on or rattling on, or you're letting your mouth carry on working while your mind's on holiday. You know that.
That's a splendid definition. Yes, it's a talker of loquacious or errant nonsense, sort of chatterbox. And it is both Scots by origin, as Dennis quite rightly says, the blatherskate that comes from blather, that goes right back into history of words, right back to Middle English. And in the United States, it became blatherskite. Apparently, it was a Scots song, Maggie Lauder, which was popular during the War of Independence. And they used this phrase, but slightly altered it, blatherskite for blatherskate. 2 marks to Dennis. Dillis Powell, pullulation. I won't spell it unless you want it.
Pullulation. It means something rather increasing, I think.
Yes, it does.
If you have rabbits, which I don't, I think they're rather apt to pullulate.
Yeah.
They multiply. They generate and multiply.
But if you had plants in your garden?
If I had what in my garden?
Had plants in your garden.
Plants. I don't have a garden, but if I had plants, they would grow, and I hope they would have seeds, and I hope the seeds would generate, and I hope they would multiply.
Fine. That's all I wanted. Pullulation, if you're talking about growing plants, it's a shoot or a budding. For a seed, it's sprouting or germination. And as Dillis said quite rightly about the rabbits, it, for them and other animals, it means a multiplication, it means progeny, it means offspring. And it comes from a Latin word originally which meant chick. 2 marks. Frank Muir. A funambulist. F-U-N-A-M-B-U-L-I-S-T. Funambulist.
Well, it was a rope dancer, an early form of entertainment in pre-Shakespeare time and after.
What kind of rope?
Tight rope.
Yes.
A funambulist.
That's what I wanted.
I could never understand why people would go to the Bear in Southwark to watch chaps walking along a rope.
In the hope they'd fall off.
Oh, yeah.
One who walks, or even in some cases, if he's very accomplished, dances on a tight rope. And again, it's 2 Latin words meaning walking on ropes. 2 marks. Anscott James, pediculous.
No, it's something unpleasant.
Very.
When it first happens to you, but I think something to which you probably get accustomed if it goes on year after year after year. It's insectuous and it means lousy.
Yes, quite right. It's of or something about a louse, or it means infested by lice, or just simply lousy. 2 marks it is. Well, for those who like to guess ahead at the stories, what is going to be the quotations which Dennis and Frank are offering today? I'd like Dennis's first.
Well, I'm offering one of the most melancholy generalizations ever made. The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation.
If any of you want to burst into tears, I hope you'll keep quiet about it. And yours, Frank?
My text this week from Isaac Watts, Divine Songs for Children, from the Divine Song entitled Against Idleness and Mischief, which starts,
How doth the little busy bee improve each shining hour?
That's a very good start.
So we come to round two, which is a, I hope, rather nostalgic round of nursery rhymes. 2 marks for correctly remembering the following. And in case anybody wants to argue, I'm taking the texts from the Oxford Nursery Rhyme book, even though Mother Goose may have it in a slightly different version, just so there won't be too much argument. Dennis Norden, I want the first and the second verses of Jack and Jill.
I don't think I ever had to go as far as the second. Jack and Jill went up the hill to get a pail of water. Jill fell down and broke...
Jack fell down and broke
his crown. And Jill came tumbling after...
That's the last one.
And take one spoonful for Cousin Edna.
Jack got up and home did trot.
That's right.
Good, yes.
Go on. Paper. And something caper. Yeah. And Jill came along with a caper. And she... And she washed his wounds and did them up in vinegar and brown paper.
I think that's so nearly right. Considering how far from childhood both of them are, I might give them 2 marks.
Well, that's a gallantry for you.
But for the record, the first verse was approximately right. For the second verse, then up Jack got and home did trot as fast as he could caper, to old Dame Bob, who patched his knob with vinegar and brown paper. Oh. 2 marks. Now, Dennis Brown, the first again and the second verses of Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Well, I had a very underprivileged childhood. I never taught any of these things. What was Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
That's about all I know, I think.
Whose fleece was black as soot. And into Mary's bread and jam his sooty footy put.
That's right.
Beyond that, we cannot...
That's why I told you I was relying on the Oxford Nursery Rhyme book in case there was some attempts like that.
His fleece was white as snow.
Yes. Yes.
And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
That's good enough for stanza one. Try two.
Is there another one?
Yes, second one. Second verse. It's a bit educational.
could you all try?
No. I won't get any marks for that.
I've never learned lip reading.
Absolutely right.
Thank you very much.
4 marks to the audience.
And this is not anonymous. This is by Sarah Josepha Hale, who died in 1879.
Oh, I didn't know.
Well, now it's Frank Mayer's turn. I want the first complete verse of Goosey, Goosey, Gander.
Goosey, goosey, gander, where shall I wander? Upstairs and downstairs and in my lady's chamber.
It's only half of it. That's the half the first verse, which it hasn't got only 4 lines, it has 8 lines.
Oh, no.
There's a bit about, I met an old man.
That's right.
Who wouldn't say his prayers.
Yes.
And I grabbed hold of his left leg and threw him down the lift shaft.
I think Frank is bound to get his marks, but again, in the interest of accuracy, Goosey, Goosey, Gander, whither shall I wander? Upstairs and downstairs and in my lady's chamber. There I met an old man who wouldn't say his prayers. I took him by the left leg and threw him down the stairs. Gamma Girton's Garland, 1784, and 2 marks. Oh. And Scott James. Again, the first complete verse of Ding Dong Bell, Pussies in the Well.
Well, you've already made it clear that I'm too old to remember. Ding Dong Bell, Pussies in the Well. Who put her in?
Yes.
Little Tommy Flynn. Who pulled her out? You see, I'm not that old. Little Tommy Stout. How does it finish?
There's another character comes in.
Not yet.
No. And wasn't that a pretty dish to set before a queen?
No.
It's about pussies and mice rather than about cats and rather than about queens and all that sort of thing.
Well, that's a
Mm-hmm. What a naughty boy he was.
Yes.
Was there to try to drown poor pussycat.
Quite right.
Yeah.
I think Anna's got as far as 1.5 marks, but again didn't complete. Ding Dong Bell, Pussy's in the Well, Who Put Her In? The Oxford version is Little Johnny Green. I used to call it Johnny Thin, so I don't know.
Yes, so do I.
Yeah, no. Hooray. Yes. Who Pulled Her Out? Little Tommy Stout. What a naughty boy was there to try to drown poor pussycat.
Well, ne'er did any harm, but killed the mice in something's
barn. I don't think I give more than 1.5.
All right.
Well, now we have a round of origins and derivations and 2 marks again. I want to know how the following words or phrases originated, or from what did they derive. Dennis Norden, an old bag.
Well, I find it hard to believe that this has got any kind of abstruse derivation. An old bag was derived from somebody who looked at somebody and was reminded of the resemblance to an old bag.
It's, I think, a little more military than that.
Bag. Were they sort of camp followers,
yes,
of some kind?
Yeah.
And they would come with the baggage. They
That's
would
right.
follow up with the baggage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
Oh, I see.
That's all right.
I still
The general impression being that they were absolutely virtuous and beautiful young ladies or not?
Oh, no, by no means. And not terribly prepossessing either.
That's all right. It goes with baggage, bag and baggage. That was what the army took around with it, its own stores and the army stores and the guns and all the rest of it. And they used to put wives or other kinds of female camp followers onto the baggage carts and take them round to, probably not being terribly respectful, and therefore they regarded them as old baggages or old bags. Oh, rather unpleasant, isn't it? Two more. Gillis Powell, a freelance by origin.
A freelance, what it means now, is generally a journalist who hasn't got a regular job and sends in to newspapers and other periodicals articles which are hastily returned.
Yes, that's fine. That's a very good modern definition. Now, what did it come from?
It means self-unemployed.
I think it comes from a military origin.
Yes? Yes.
A mercenary. I mean, anyhow, a lance, a holder of a lance, a supporter of a lance, a soldier with a lance who was not attached to an army.
Yes, what did he do?
Have lance will travel.
Exactly.
He joined up with anybody who would employ his lance.
That's it. This was in the Middle Ages, and when after the Crusades, there were a fair number of warriors who were unemployed, and they were prepared to carry their lance on behalf of any master or any cause, not bothering very much whether it was good or bad, provided that they were properly paid. They were also called the free companions. 2 marks. Frank Muir, a jot or tittle.
A jot or tittle is something very small,
yes,
and insignificant. Possibly refers to the sort of talent which a gossip writer needs to jot down tittle-tattle.
That's a good description of what
Thank
it is.
Thank you. 2 marks.
No. I want to know where it comes from.
Printing.
Printing helps.
Printing. Comes from printing, Jack.
Comes from printing.
It helps quite a lot.
It's cut an iota. Cousin,
that's what I wanted.
Iota.
1.5 you get.
Iota.
A jot
well,
is...
Not 1 iota.
That's right. A jot is a perversion of iota, which is just the smallest letter in the whole Greek alphabet. Tittle came from the Latin titulus, and it could be the dot over the letter I, or a stroke, or an accent, or a punctuation mark, as Dillis quite rightly said. It means something very, very small, inconsiderable amount. And Scott James, write as a trivet.
This is something to do with wrought iron, isn't it? Trivet.
I think they're usually wrought iron, but they could be other metals. Or even
a trivet is a three-legged thing on which,
right,
on which a witch puts her cauldron, isn't it?
Absolutely right. Well, not only a witch, but
a witch, you put your... anybody puts a kettle.
Yes. And why is it right as a?
Because unless it's standing absolutely on its all three legs levelly, the kettle will boil over, I would think. It's a sign of stability, equability.
You're so very nearly right. Now, if it had four legs, would it do as well?
Oh, no.
Two would be even worse.
One would be the absolute end, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think the end gets some marks, two marks. A trivet, which was originally a three-legged stand or tripod, will normally stand firmly and won't wobble, even if the floor on which it's put is uneven. It was later substituted by these funny things used to fix onto the front of a grate with three projections. You put it onto the top bar of the grate, and that, quite wrongly, became known as a trivet. Two marks. Well, now we come to the last round, and to Dennis and Frank's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Dennis, your quotation, which came from Henry Thoreau's Economy, was, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation."
Not long ago, I was addle-headed enough to let myself be roped into one of those bone-achingly po-faced late-night TV discussions. You know, on marriage, this one was, you know, kind of, do married women make the best wives? You know, that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, I heard my name called, and the chairman was saying, "What about you, Dennis? Do you think it right for a couple to sleep together before marriage?" And without thinking, I said, "Do I think it right? I think it's absolutely essential." Well, I can't tell you what ructions that created. Within seconds, the telephone switchboard was practically running molten from the heat that was generated. Dozens upon dozens of voices screaming, "How can you allow that decadent roué to come on the public television and advocate premarital sex?" Well, the truth of the matter is, I wasn't advocating anything of the kind. What I was referring to had absolutely nothing to do with sex. I was thinking about marriage. You see, because where young men are concerned, there's only one area of ignorance that we don't fill them in on when they enter marriage nowadays, and that area is not the one dealing with sex, because as far as that's concerned, you've only got to look at the bookstalls now. Sex today comes with more instruction manuals than a hydraulic forklift truck. No, for all our so-called frankness, the one fact of life that we still conceal from male adolescents is in another area completely. It is the fact that women snore as well. I sincerely believe that there are some things which the union of two people was never intended to withstand. One is putting up wallpaper together. The second is spending five rainy days in a caravan. And the third is lying staring at the ceiling, waiting for the next rumble from the spark-out body next to you. Because it's a demonstrable fact that out of any two people, the one who snores is also the one who always goes to sleep first. But you may ask, don't men snore? Yes, of course they do, but A, they've kept no secret of it down the years. And the second thing is, when a man snores, he does it somehow rhythmically, evenly. Though the person beside him, it is true, madam. The person lying beside, if it be yourself, madam, when you lie beside a snoring man, you can accustom yourself to the sound. You can even be lulled by it. But when a woman snores, it's spasmodic, it's irregular, and every so often they make a sound that is absolutely heart-stopping. A sort of snorting gasp that's peculiarly urgent. It's like a diver who suddenly got his airline crossed. So, now do you see why I publicly advocated that a couple sleep together before marriage? I think it was sex. Just to find out if she snores. Because it may be that some men are content with a partner who makes every night hideous with her nasal obligato. But as Henry Thoreau, so approximately observed, the mass of men need wives of quiet respiration.
Well, a full company of women's lib will be at Dennis's front door tomorrow. So we pass on hastily to Frank Muir. And if you remember, his quotation was, "How doth the little busy bee improve each shining hour?"
I have a little sort of private excitement at the moment because for many, many years I've suffered under an affliction which none of you would have noticed, but it was very worrying to me, and that is failure to pronounce my R's, which is totally unrecognisable in the way I speak. But I always had a feeling that my R's came out like W's. I thought there was no solution at all to my problem, and then I was walking in the back streets behind Putney High Street, and I suddenly came across this little building which had a very discreet sign which said, "Putney College of Pronunciation." The Putney College of Pronunciation, I thought to myself, thought I. This is surely for me. And in I went, and I saw this terribly nice chap, Mr. Smithers, and said, "Do you do deal with defects in voices?" He said, "Yes, we do, sir." He said, "We're a small organisation here at the PCP, but we pride ourselves on correcting defects in people's speaking apparatus." And he said, "For instance, may I show you?" And he showed me into the first room, and the voice said, "This is your guard speaking. British Railway." But he said, "Just a moment. Mr. Baxter, you're still audible. Hi, Mr. Smithers. This is your guard speaking. This train, the intercity train, will arrive at 4:10 in London, for which British Railway apologises, as it is the Newcastle train." And he went into the next room, and there was a man going, "I don't believe it. What were you expected to believe these days?" So I said, "Who is that?" He said, "Well, that's the firm's accountant." I said, "Well, can you help me with my R's, because I can't pronounce my R's?" He said, "Yes, we can do that, sir. We are a small organisation here, Putney College of Pronunciation, but the PCP, you can agree, will help you." So what he did was he fixed me up with two gadgets, a couple of elastic bands, and widened out paper clips. And you hook the paper clips in the corners of your mouth and put the elastic bands over your ears, and it pulls the mouth back, and you could pronounce your R's much more easily. And I have an exercise which I have to practice every day, 42 times a day. And it's working. Excuse me being so enthusiastic, but may I read my exercise to you? And you'll see how well it's worked since, say, 3 years ago. Here's my exercise.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?
I'm at Ruislip.
Renovating whistles and reviving rotten radishes, ready to receive a randy receptionist Ruth. Can you wonder at my enthusiasm, at my continuing improvement? How doth the little PCP improve each shining hour?
Well, I'm glad Frank's story had a happy ending. Because by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the contest of stories, and he and Dilys Powell also win this entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dilys Powell, Dennis Norton and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.